Whenever we talk about giants, beings who are physically immense, from 8 feet, 10 feet, 12 feet and beyond, where is the evidence? It's all stories. It's lots of articles. And we have had the top people on the show. We've heard from Hugh Newman, Xavier Hayes, Richard Dewhurst, and many others. And most of it is archives from the Smithsonian, research from the past, local community, newspapers reporting on digs that are from the 1800s. We have stone tools. We have some large arrowheads scattered here and there. But really, that's about it. But have we ever seen any physical remains? Do we have any bones? No, we don't. And hold on to your hats today, people, because today's show has historic implications. After years of interviews discussing giants, today we'll speak to Mary Sutherland, who has written a number of books on the red-haired giants of Wisconsin. And Mary is going to provide photographs from a recent dig that unearthed a 8-foot giant in Wisconsin. Now, not only is this an 8-foot giant, it actually gets even better. This giant has an elongated skull. And to date, I don't know of anyone who has posted photographs of a gravesite of one of these giants. And this is a phenomenal discovery. This is historic. It's newsworthy. And remember, for the most part, in our country, in the United States, these types of discoveries are considered hush-hush and in some cases illegal. The Native American community, very protective of grave sites they consider theirs. So what we're looking at is highly confidential. You might even say classified. So we'll have that on to the program today. And again, historic for a number of reasons, simply because no one knows what the hell these guys look like. And now we have the evidence. Very exciting. Now, we're also going to go to England today and speak with a video producer who has captured a number of very old sites and also excellent in capturing megaliths in Europe and in South America. We'll hear from our media critic, Adam Young, who will tell us what the latest is on a number of excellent topics. It's always good to hear from Adam. But the real bombshell today are these impressive images of a gravesite revealing a long-headed giant. And this is a huge human being. We don't know how old it is. We don't know any specifics because the person who is doing the dig is keeping things very, very confidential, eliminating their exposure. And what we're going to discuss today is unprecedented. It's the latest, the greatest, and it is an eye-opener. All this and the news today on Earth Ancients. For April 14th, 2018, this is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Earth Ancients. I hope your week has been flowing. You know, last week I mentioned that I had done this fast, and I didn't really talk a lot about it. it's kind of personal in some ways. Simply because everybody reacts differently when they stop eating. And a lot of our parents would say, that's dangerous, you're going to die. There's even physicians that say it's terrible to do that, you know. But in the old world, and not so long ago in the 60s, there were people that had sanitariums. People like here in California, a guy named Bernard Jensen, Kellogg in Michigan had sanitariums where he would have people do long fasts. And it's been known about, not by orthodoxy, not by conventional allopathic medicine, but it's by real healers. And I'm sorry to say, I don't think allopathic medicine is about healing. It's about disease control, disease detection. But anyhow, I did this 7-day fast, came off it on the 8th, last Sunday. And up until I think I mentioned I was on the 5th day last time. On the 6th day, I started really feeling pretty weak and not really 100%. And then on the 7th day, I broke the fast at 6 o'clock. I had some steamed tomatoes in a broth and began to break the fast. Now, what I discovered, and I've done fasting off and on for a number of years. This time, it was for a number of reasons. To drop some weight. Also to, just feel better. I was carrying too much weight. And, 12 pounds is amazing. I remember on the 9th day, I looked in the mirror. I was like, who in the hell is that? So I'm very happy with the results. I find that they're amazing. I gained a couple of pounds back. I think I got down to 178. I think I'm up to 180, maybe 179. But the key to these fasts is breaking them. And you don't start eating regular food. I didn't eat any protein for 4 days. I ate raw salads and soups, a lot of steamed veggies. And on the second day of the broken, on the 9th or 10th day, I actually had some toast, some whole wheat toast. So, but I'll tell you, they are, I feel really great. And I am here to say that they are effective. We don't know enough about the physiology to say exactly how the body cleanses itself. Because there hasn't been a lot of fasting testing done in terms of how the physical body, the physiology, the blood, the organs, the digestive, the elimination systems work when you're in these states. But I feel a lot better. I feel better. I feel more energetic. And it's not something to do a lot. It really has to be supervised. And the other thing is, I was talking to some friends, and you cannot do these in a work environment. There's just too many interruptions, and you have to be quiet, and you have to be, luckily I work from home, so I was able to do this while I was doing my regular job. And I actually went in to one of my clients, which is about a 30-mile drive. I was okay for that, but I wouldn't really suggest doing it in a very busy, intense environment. It's just there's too many distractions, and you want to stay on the course. So 7-day fast. Oh, and by the way, I mentioned that I was following Jason Fong's program. I have done that, but I came back and was really following tight guidance with Dr. Paul Bragg and Dr. Bernard Jensen. They've passed years and years ago. Dr. Bernard Jensen wrote a book called Nature Has a Remedy. And Paul Bragg wrote a book, I think the title is just Fasting. It's just called Fasting. And these old guys, I know Bernard Jensen, I don't know about Bragg, but Bernard Jensen had a clinic down in Escondido, California, and he saw thousands of people and helped them regain their health through a number of various programs, and fasting it was one of them. Now, he took some people, 30-day fast. There's no way. No way. I can't. 7 days was tough. I might go to a 10 in the future, but a 30-day pass, no way. I can't even imagine that. Just water And I had a little coffee and some tea, but 30 days. So fasting. By the way, I mentioned in the beginning of the show that I will be revealing some photographs of this longhead giant from Wisconsin that my guest today, Mary Sutherland, has provided me. And it wasn't her. It wasn't her dig. It was a private research investigator and his team. I cannot give out the name for various reasons, but I'm only going to post one, possibly two of these photographs because they're so rare. You can see the entire gallery, which isn't, I mean, it's maybe 8 to 10 photos, if you go to the Patreon page. And this is an exclusive release of these unusual photographs. And so all you got to do is go to patreon.com/earthancients and become a subscriber to Earth Ancients. When you're a subscriber, you support the work we do here. And for as little as $5 a month, you can access unpublished interviews, videos, and galleries. So check it out. Patreon, patreon.com/earthancients and become a subscriber. I want to send out a special thank you to this week's subscribers. Each of you is supporting Earth Ancients. Thank you to Adam Young, Megri Jade Jackson, Andrew Lead, and Walter Remkunis. And I want to thank each of you, and I appreciate it. Oh, hey, by the way, last week, we had King Kaufman on the show, the producer of New Living Expo. Remember, that's coming up April 27th through the 29th, end of this month. Good show. He provided me with 5 pairs of tickets, and we still have a couple of pairs left. So if you want to get one of those pairs, it's good for one day, accessing pretty much everything except for maybe some of the special workshops, which are additional. Send me an email. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com. And that reminds me, Victoria from Contact in the Desert, she's doing a raffle for the June 1st show. That's going to be down in Palm Desert. Send me an email. I only had a couple of people respond to that, and that is the foremost show in America for all things unexplained, but in specific terms, ancient unknown civilizations, and then the ancient alien side of things too. And for each of those events, go to their website, newlivingexpo.com and contactinthedesert.com for their program guides. They're all digital. Send me an email for tickets to Contact. Go to cliff@earthancients.com and I'll get what I can to you. Get in there, get under the wire, because they're probably going to be gone pretty soon. Okay, it's time to read a couple of emails from you. I always appreciate emails. If you want to send me an email, let me know what you think of the show, have some ideas, some suggestions for speakers, or just to say hi, I always appreciate it. You can send me an email at cliff@earthancients.com. And most of the time I read them. Sometimes they're filled with a little too much material, technical stuff, or they're not appropriate. So, but I'd say 95% or more are there. I can read them. So here we go. All right. The first one today is from Susan. Susan says, "Hi, I'm another Ohio listener who is really enjoying your podcast. I'm in the process of listening to your previous episodes while I'm making grandma trips to Atlanta. Makes the time really fly. The month on Egypt was a real eye-opener. You put out an outstanding amount of information in each show, and I really enjoy your interviewing style and your choice of guests. Thanks for providing so much important knowledge. My little world has grown a lot since I've been listening. Susan." Susan, I really appreciate that. That's nice to hear from you. So the Egyptian issue, the Egyptian episode was of interest to you. I want to remind you guys that the show's been on since April of 2014. You can go to earthancients.com and go to the top and plug in a specific topic, Egypt, giants, whatever, and it'll come up with a list of shows that have been recorded. We've done a lot of work already. Of course, we're continuing to do good work. But if you have a topic you're interested in, get in there, because the show's been around for a while, and a lot of our speakers, we have a lot of people on specific subjects that are kind of fun to check out. So earthancients.com. Okay, this is from Bruce. Bruce says, "Dear Cliff, I'm very encouraged by your work and breaking forbidden roadblocks erected by conventional archaeology and anthropology to prevent finding out the truth about human history. Are you familiar with Dr. Susan B. Martinez? Her 2013 book, The Lost History of Little People, Their Spiritually Advanced Civilizations Around the World." Well, Bruce, we had Dr. Martinez on the program. We've had her a couple of times. She is a good writer. She is a real academic. And that book on little people we featured, it was interesting. I learned a lot simply because the little people apparently crossed from Lemuria and Mu into Mexico. And there's real, really good evidence of them kind of becoming part of the Maya, the culture of Maya. Maya are a multiracial group. Okay, Susan goes on and she says, "I have a lengthy book review published under her book on Amazon.com. What impresses me about her work is that she seems to have not only provided evidence for a worldwide culture of little people related to the ancient Bushmen of Africa who navigated the seas and lived on large islands in the Pacific during the last ice age. She wrote a companion book published the same year, The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man." And we also had her for that too, by the way. We talked about that. "She seems to have preempted recent developments in anthropology and DNA analysis that indicates significant interbreeding between at least 8 different hominin species for the last 2,500 years or more. You might want to read her books. She graduated from Columbia University with a PhD in anthropology. What is freaky is that many of her insights came from a 19th century American Bible called the OASPE. And I remember her talking about that. Yes, if you haven't guessed, I am siding with the ancient alien theorists. Sincerely, Bruce." And Bruce is a PhD geology and paleobotany from El Paso, Texas. Bruce, thank you very much. I'm a fan of Susan's, and I speak to her off and on. And I believe that there's huge evidence of these migrating little people in through Central and North America. So, again, if you want to send me an email, I really appreciate reading them. Send it to cliff@earthancients.com. So about a month ago, I was surveying YouTube, and I ran across some excellent videos. I mean, the very well edited, and the one I was looking at was in South America. And the gentleman behind this YouTube program is a guy named Mick Hobday, and Mick is coming to us from England right now. He has created a fascinating website. It's really well done. It's called Modern Explorers. Not only is it captivating, it's actually well composed. Mick, how are you, man?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm great. Hey, tell us how you got started on this website. It's great. And your YouTube channels are excellent. So talk a little bit about how you got into this.
Well, it was all very sort of organic in a way. I mean, I'm a traveler actually at heart. I've been traveling for the last 15 years. And more or less when the world didn't explode at the end of 2012, you know, I just decided to do something. And I wanted to obviously make a website because everyone has one, and videoing sort of appealed to me really. And the thing I wanted to talk about the most was these megalithic sites that I've been visiting. I was kind of filling a niche, if you like, because there wasn't much online about it at the time. So that was where I thought I could contribute to this this awakening, if you like, or uplift of consciousness or whatever it was. So yeah, it was very organic. I honestly don't really know when it happened, you know. Yeah. It was just,
well, I mean, we were doing megaliths last week. We were focusing on megaliths and this megalithic tour of Portugal, which I'm going to put on our link to our Facebook page, is excellent. And you obviously have a interest in ancient cultures. And for those of you listening, I will post this on the Facebook and the website. But Mick has done a superb job in capturing these locations. So you have a total right now of about 7 on the YouTube channel, right?
I'm not sure because I've actually got 3 YouTube channels, but that's the main one. And I think it is, but I have lots of other little videos as well on there, you know. And because I basically taught myself, so there's some that at the beginning that were just shorter while I was learning how to edit and those kind of things. So okay. In total, there's probably 20 odd or something, but okay. It wasn't until the last few years was I really feeling happy with the quality of my work. So those are probably like the 6 or 7 that you talk about that are actually, in my opinion, you know, pretty good anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you have Easter Island, you have ruins under Stonehenge, you have pyramids of Bosnia, Göbekli Tepe, Adam's Calendar, which is in South Africa. Wow, you have a lot on here. So
yeah,
fantastic. So you have an interest in ancient culture, obviously.
Oh, definitely. I mean, just while I was, you know, at the beginning of my travel career, I was drawn to these sites. And you know, when you see such places as you know, the ruins in Peru and Guatemala, that you they're so impressive. Even to somebody back then, you know, I was only sort of early 20s when I saw these places. They hit you, you know, and then you as you sort of research more, as you know, as time goes by, you realize how deep this this topic is. And the megalithic one was you know, I saw actually one of your guests, Hugh Newman. I saw him interviewed on Project Camelot, and he mentioned that there was 19,000 dolmen in South Korea, and that was the moment I remember thinking, wow, what the hell are these things, you know? Like, and my research has just gone from there, basically.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've done a great job, and I'm like, again, I'll post this information for our listening audience. Before I let you go, what is your draw to the ancient world? What's your personal draw? I mean, are you interested just because you think there's a message that's been left for us and that we're not paying attention enough to the ancient past, or you just have a general curiosity?
Well, kind of yes to all of the above, really. I mean, I've been drawn to these sites, and I find them, you know, very curious, but I also believe that they are the evidence of a global culture in our past that was most likely had, you know, technology and had ways of, you know, using their spiritual aspect of their bodies and were pretty advanced. And, you know, my focus is to show that they're global. As I said, I was a traveler. And when you see that these dolmen are, you know, scattered all over the world, like Russia and India and Korea and Middle East, and then the circles again, they're found in different areas all around the world. And just for me, it seems obvious that there was a global civilization, or at least that they were communicating or something along those lines, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a definite, I was pulled towards it, and I'm absolutely sure that we, you know, we were global and highly advanced in our past.
Fantastic. Again, for those of you listening, I am going to post this, the You can go to modernexplorers.co.uk and see the entire link. But if they went directly to YouTube, would they just punch in Modern Explorers and that would they go to that page?
I think so. I mean, the best way is to go via the website, I think, because there's some other Modern Explorer seems to be quite a popular name. So right. I think if you Google it, it's I'm not even in the top 10 or something.
Okay, so I'm going to post it for those of you listening again. I'll post this on the Facebook page and the website, so you don't have to worry about trying to figure it out. And that way, you can go directly right to the page with these many, many, many. Videos. And by the way, I just want to compliment you. You do a very good job on your videos. They're clean, they're well shot, and the sound's good.
Thank you. Really.
That's huge. Okay. That's our guest has been Mick Hobday. Mick, thank you. Continued success, and we'll keep uploading your material.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's time to check in with our media critic, Adam Young. And this week, Adam has brand new content, and we want to check in with him. Adam, how you doing, man?
Hey, Cliff. How are you?
I'm good. Okay, so what do you got for us?
All right. So I mentioned Jimmy from Bright Insights a couple times in the past. I like him a lot. He's passionate about the subject, and he has a lot of good things to say. So this episode is titled Tunnels Underground. Sometimes his titles aren't 100% clear, but the link is on the Facebook page. And he hits up a couple of topics on this one. He talks about the fact that the Earth, or that humans in general, went through a number of cataclysms. He points out some of the meteor craters that were formed that are, you know, one of the tributes to the dinosaurs. And then some of the other ones appear to have happened in the middle of what I think scientists would say is an early time in humanity, but a lot of other people would actually say was one of humanity's peaks. So he talks a little bit about that for the first half of the episode. And then the second half, he discusses a number of underground cities, and there are hundreds of them, I think, around the world, particularly in Europe and the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And these are hundreds of feet down, sometimes multiple layers, 11 to 12 stories sometimes, again, hundreds of feet under the earth. The traditional story is that they were built to avoid armies and invaders and foreign conquerors, but the level of engineering, architecture involved doesn't really speak to that. It would be way too big of an infrastructure project merely to avoid armies when you could erect a wall or raise your own army. So he talks about that to some extent. He also has a lot of good pictures and videos.
Cool.
And he talks about Derinkuyo, which is in the Cappadocia region of Turkey. It's one of the biggest ones. It's like 4 square miles or 5 square miles. And there's an extra tunnel that links it to another city. So this was built to house 20,000 people and livestock and animals. And it just doesn't compute if you think it's to merely hide from people. So I like this episode. It's from last year, but it is still pretty relevant. So that's the first one.
Okay, cool.
The second one is a book. It's called Dead Men's Secrets by Jonathan Gray. It was written in the early 2000s, and it's a bit unorthodox. It doesn't really have a clear plot line or a story per se. It's more of this gentleman's observations over probably most of his lifetime. He has anecdotal evidence and data points of all sorts of anomalies throughout the world. So everything from lost hidden technology to stories of people living underground and emerging underground, even after the end of the last ice age. So in the last 2000 years, he also has evidence or stories that pertain to what culture might've been like back in the day or before the ice age ended. There are cave paintings in China, for instance, that depict people with modern clothing or modern attire, like tight fitting suits, leather pants that are tailored, women carrying handbags or purses, wearing jewelry and earrings. And these, at least the carbon dating from some of these, would bring it back 10,000 years or more. And that doesn't really correspond to what we think of ancient people. You know, any history textbook has people wearing animal skins and togas, but in reality, if the culture was advanced, they would be concerned with their appearance. And I think things like that, data points like that, can sometimes get lost in the mix when you're talking about technology only. But if you think about the day-to-day concerns that people have, that's a whole host of evidence there. A lot of his data and his you know, quote-unquote evidence in here is not really documented very well. So I found myself trying to spot check some of the things he mentions. I think in general, most of it is correct or accurate, but a lot of it is kind of difficult to double check. So keep that in mind.
Okay, cool. Excellent. And then what do we got? Number three, what's the third suggestion for this week's reading or streaming media?
Right. So the last one is another YouTube documentary, and it's by New Earth. They have a YouTube channel. It's called The Star Forts of Malta. And it's Malta. One of the earlier ones.
Yeah, we haven't had enough about Malta, so that's cool. That's a very ancient site. Yeah,
Malta's really interesting. It seems to predate the cataclysm or the end of the last ice age, and there are all sorts of archaeological anomalies on the island. There are these fortresses that are called star forts that are attributed to the Crusaders and other Middle Eastern empires, but they seem to be built on earlier structures, which is kind of a theme. You can see different layers of construction. On the top, you have small geometrically shaped blocks on top of older megalithic stones. Mm-hmm. So they focus on those. You can see evidence of stairways on the outside of the building, which were removed by perhaps the Crusaders, who knows. But why would you build stairs on the outside of a fortress? And that's one of the points that they make, which I think is kind of profound. It doesn't really make sense. If you're trying to keep people out, you wouldn't give them a staircase to climb over the walls. They also discuss caverns, tunnels, and other underground structures throughout the whole island, as well as other anomalies like what seem to be tire tracks or other sorts of perhaps vehicle markings in what was once clay or earth that's now hardened into stone, and a whole host of other issues. So that's Malta. It's a small island, and there seems to be quite a lot going on there.
Fantastic. As always, great suggestions from our media critic, Adam Young. For those of you listening, I will be posting these links on the Facebook page, but also that will be transferred automatically to the Earth Ancients website, and this is how you can access this material. Adam, as always, excellent, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks, Cliff. Take care.
The boys I've known, and I've known some.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Coming to you live from around the world, it's Earth Ancient News.
Each week we bring you news from around the world. A lot of the galleries and information is from you, the listener, taking trips to exotic places. Some of the material is also from people who live in Europe, in Asia, any place, and who are submitting galleries and articles and information, which I appreciate. This information is located on Facebook. You can go to Facebook, Earth Ancients, go to the group or the international page, and it automatically loads to the earthancients.com website. Go to the Facebook feed button and press it, and you can see all these rather than going to Facebook itself. Scientists in Canada have found a number of footprints that are dated around 13,000 years ago. These are on the Pacific coast of British Columbia, and this is interesting for a number of reasons. One is the speculation is growing that a lot of these people came across from the Pacific Ocean, transatlantic journey, rather than the Bering Strait story that we've been told for decades. And what's unique is this is about 29 different footprint, and it was two adults and a child. Imprints have been dated to 13,000 years before present. Great evidence. In fact, the lead author, Duncan McLaurin, says that this finding proves evidence of a seafaring people who inhabited this area during the tail end of the last major ice age. So it's very cool. I mean, they don't, he doesn't get into the details about, you know, where they originated. But I love these kinds of reports. We have a new video from our friend Chuck at CApps7865. This is a video, short video, it's about 5 minutes, on the Great Mound of St. Louis. I've never heard about this. Apparently, and those of you who live in the area where there are great mounds and a number of mounds, during the 1800s, many of these mounds were bulldozed over, flattened for access with roads and for city building, and they would use these mounds, they would dig through them. This is a very unique mound called the St. Louis Mound, multiple tons in size. It's about 20 feet tall. There's a number of really good photographs of before and after. And this is just part of the world. This happens in Europe and has happened for centuries. The buildings of previous people are disassembled and used for newer buildings, or in this case, the entire mound was deconstructed and used for local fields and building and things like that. But I didn't realize how big this mound was. It's massive. So a nice little piece by our friend Chuck. Chuck, thank you. And by the way, it's CFAPPS7865, and I will post this to Facebook. Finally, technology is really moved forward in terms of scanning old buildings and reconstructing them. There's a new technology that was just announced that allows scientists to scan an old ruin and use drone technology to measure and decipher what the actual size of some of these buildings were. And we have a really nice piece where 7 ancient ruins were brought back to their original look and appearance. So the scans are of a number of noted locations, including the Parthenon in Athens, Greece, the main pyramid, Chmul at Koba in Yucatan, where I've been there many times, and it's kind of a cool reproduction. Temple of Jupiter in Pompeii, Italy, a number of castles, and even the Luxor Temple in Luxor, Egypt, the site of one of Ramses II's buildings. Fabulous sculptures that have been reproduced and buildings. So, oh yeah, and also the Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan has been completely reconstructed, and you can see the details. The article features a whole bunch of other links to other scans they've done. And this is the future. This is what the future is scanning these images, getting details, and bringing them back to life so we see what they look like. And this helps archaeologists quite a bit. As always, we have tons of galleries, too much to discuss here. It would take a whole show to go into every single piece of news that we have and photographs and galleries and things like that. So go to the Facebook page, go to earthancients.com, and check it out. This week's interview is brought to you by Journey to the Land of the Maya. This is the pyramid tour that I'll be hosting in November, November 17th through the 24th in Yucatan, Mexico. This is a great way to see Mayan ruins up close and personal. We'll have a guide. We'll have Mimo Gonzalez with us, who is an amazing guide. The reason he's great is that he takes us off the beaten track and we see places that typically are not shown to tourists. And I appreciate that because there's a lot of continual excavations going on, and I want to see those. I want to see what they're finding. But we'll go to the classics. We'll go see Uxmal, Chichen Itza, Xbalam, Edzna. We'll be in Campeche. We'll be actually also going to the Caribbean side. Our home base will be Mérida, the capital of Yucatan, a colonial city, beautiful. We'll have our hotel there. We'll be bused to wherever we need to go. And this is a fascinating trip that I take every year, and I take just a few people. If you want to join me, get me an email. Go to cliff@earthancients.com, or you can see the entire itinerary by going to earthancients.com/tours. Come out and join me. This is one of those amazing tours we do every year, and it's a blast. I was recently looking back at our discussions on ancient giants around the world and here in the United States. And back in October 17th, 2015, we had a panel discussion of experts called Giants of the Ancient World. And since that time, we've had just a sprinkling of people talking about giants around the world. Huge humans that occupied various parts of North America. That panel included Hugh Newman, Xavier Hayes, Patrick Chenard, and a new author to our program, Mary Sutherland. And little did I know that Mary is a powerhouse of research. And since that time, I've followed her off and on in her books. She's written a number of different books. But what I want to do today is not only talk about the giants that she has written about, but also some of these amazing discoveries that she has found along with none other than Frank Joseph. Now, we've had Frank on the program quite a bit, and this is a underwater structure. In fact, I've seen pictures of it. It's a pyramid at Rock Lake in Wisconsin. We're going to talk to Mary a little bit more about that. But Mary is an author. She's a researcher. A lot of her work focuses on consciousness studies, ancient history, unusual phenomenon. And she is a prolific writer. She's written books like Living in the Light, Believe in the Magic, Haunted Burlington, Wisconsin, The Red-Haired Giants, which we're going to talk about today, Giant Gods and Lost Races, and other books like Lost in Time, In Search of Ancient Man. So this is going to be quite an interesting talk. Now, Mary isn't one to just sit by and let things happen. She puts her boots on and she hits the road. So it's great to have her on. Mary, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on, Cliff.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. Now, tell me about your relationship with Frank Joseph. Frank's quite a prolific author himself. But how did you get involved working with him?
Well, for one thing, our work pretty much paralleled each other at that time, and still does yet today. Mm-hmm. But so I had always followed Frank, but I was always kind of intimidated as well, you know, just to just contact him. Mm-hmm. So years went by, and I started up the Sci-Fi Cafe.
Right.
And with the Sci-Fi Cafe, I started to, because it was a really big place, you know, I had a lot of square footage. And so I thought, well, you know, because I used to have BUFO radio. So, you know, I'd interviewed Frank a few times. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I decided that I was going to start doing conferences. And I did conferences, I think, for about 6 years.
Now, I read about this. This is the Vortex Conference, right?
Right.
Yeah, tell us about that. I produce conferences, too, so I'm interested. Tell me. What was it about?
Well, they've changed a lot since then. When I first started, you could actually make money.
Okay.
But then, you know, in the last few years, I could see the writing on the wall that, you know, that there just wasn't really that type of money to be made anymore. So, you know, I just kind of fell back on that. But what I'm getting at is that is where I physically met Frank, is because I had invited him to be a speaker there at the conference. Mm-hmm. And I got to know a lot of the, you know, a lot of people there. Don Schmidt, he used to talk a lot on UFOs. Stanton Friedman would be there. Kathy Martin.
Right.
Frank Joseph. A lot of different people. I used to pull in a lot of physicists, too.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so we did that for about 6 years. And we kept it, I focused on a large, a large market.
Right.
You know, I didn't want to just target myself to one, you know, group of interest, like just UFOs or ghostly phenomena. So I would have different speakers there, some talking on UFOs, others strange phenomena,
mm-hmm.
You know, some ancient history. And, of course, that was Frank Joseph's forte was the, ancient history.
Right.
And sacred sites. So we got to be real good friends, as a matter of fact. You know, we joke about it that we're brother and sisters. You know, he comes down quite a lot. We've worked on the underwater pyramids of Rock Lake for the last 6 years.
Right.
And I usually I see him about once a year, you know, up there in, where is that? In Michigan. They have a big conference up there, and I usually go up there as a speaker, and Frank's up there as a speaker. So,
wow.
You know, so we get to, you know, kind of catch up.
Right. Well, you write quite a bit, too, about Rock Lake. This is a something that I have heard bits and pieces about. Now, you guys actually went in on the lake, and Frank dove, and this is back in, I guess, 2009, I guess, and published photographs of some of these underwater structures. Let's start from the top. What do we know about Rock Lake? Does it have a history? It's in Wisconsin. We know there's native people there. I guess I can't. How do you pronounce the name? The Sauk Indians?
Sauk.
Sauk Indians.
S-A-U-K.
S-A-U-K.
And I was actually able to trace those people all the way back to the days of the Mahabharata, the Vedic texts. They were under a different name, but still were what we have as Sauk Indians today.
Okay, the Mahabharata goes back. Doesn't it go back like 7,000-8,000 years?
If not longer.
Yeah, they're pretty. That's very, very old. So anyhow, you trace them back to a very old period. Obviously, who knows where they came from, or are they natives that were from migrated from another Pacific or Atlantic location?
What I try to do with my books, and I've been doing, I think, a very good job of it, because I use references, sources, mm-hmm. so that, you know, people aren't saying, oh, well, she's just making this stuff up as she goes along. So, you know, if I had to take that, if this was a case in court, you know, I feel I could win, I could actually win the case, mm-hmm. that Atlantis was in North America. And up into the Nova Scotia area of Canada.
Okay.
Well,
let me stop you right there. You mean there was the island that's in the...
No, not Plato's Atlantis. But I think Plato's Atlantis, and I'm going out this summer to Nova Scotia and check this whole thing out. But I think that Plato's Atlantis was possibly up in the Nova Scotia area. But people have to realize that they cannot look at the landmass of yesterday's and compare them to today. Mm-hmm. Because the world looked very, very different at that point of time than it does today. Okay. Due to the shifting of the plates and the drifting of the continents.
Okay.
Because when Lemuria and Atlantis first started out, it was during the days of Pangaea. And so at that point of time, all those land masses were kind of pushed together as one. And I have a map showing how this works on my website. But as they were pushed together as one, you can see that Egypt toenailed New York. Mm-hmm. It was a part of New York, and Morocco toenailed New Jersey.
So they're one huge landmass.
Yeah, and we're all together. That's why we have basically the same traditions. And then when the cataclysms hit, they started splitting apart and they drifted away. And now you have them spread all over.
Interesting.
And see, this is where people make their biggest mistake trying to research Atlantis, is they're not taking into consideration of how this land looked back 10,500 BC compared to what it looks like today.
Okay.
And so what they need to do is go back there and study on the old maps, which will show you exactly the locations.
Okay. So let's talk about Rock Lake. Who was the first one to determine these underwater pyramids and these stone structures? Was it somebody in the 1800s or was it sooner than that?
Oh, well, nobody really knew too much about it as far as what it looked like underneath the water, except by getting local Indian lore, because no one was able to get down there until the scuba diving gear had been invented.
Interesting. So it's about what, 20 feet, 30 feet from the surface? How deep is it?
How big is what?
How deep is the lake?
It's deep. I mean, it depends on, you know, I don't have the exact, depth right now. But, I mean, you know, there's places that's 60, 80 foot deep.
Wow.
You know, now there's also certain areas in that lake that are bottomless. Now you have to take into the consideration that from what I have in my books, I was able to show that these people that built these pyramids were the precursors to the Mayan and the Aztec people. See, most of what you read today, where they talk about the Aztec and the Mayan coming up into this area, where the area of Atzilan and Rock Lake, they always talk about the second migration. Mm-hmm. But the first migration was the people of Rock Lake and Atzilan leaving and going south. When they went into Mexico, they became the Aztec. When they went down into the Yukon area or the Yucatan area, they became the Mayans.
The interesting thing about that, though, is I've seen the photographs that Frank has published and some of the work that you have in your book, and none of the structure, especially that stone wall underneath the lake and what appears to be a pyramid, have any similarities to anything I've seen in Central or South America. So it's a unique kind of a people, but that doesn't mean that
they're... that one that you see in the pictures mm-hmm. is different than the one that we discovered.
Okay.
Now, we've been working on this for 6 years, you know, hiring, you know, people to take us out on the lake and mapping it with, you know, the most updated equipment we could get. And so basically we, in those 6 years, have actually pretty much mapped out the that entire area.
Okay.
And, you know, so we're able to show, even with GPS readings, we're able to show where these structures are and actually get an accurate GPS reading. So if anyone wants to go there, we can provide them with the information of what's out there
mm-hmm.
and exactly where it can be found through GPS readings.
Now, in this article I read from Frank Joseph in the Atlantis Rising magazine that talks about these underwater stone structures, he mentions that before he made his dive, there were other divers that found these stone circles. Can you talk a little bit about these stone circles?
Right. Now, you have to remember, go back to what I said, that none of this had been discovered up until they had been able to create the scuba diving equipment. Now, we found these. They look, let's see, how would I describe them? They look like rock, they're like rock circles.
Right.
Okay. But Frank actually went down in one, and it just kept going and going and going. And he was the only person that was diving. He was with, now this is a story he told me, because he was with Wayne May at the time, not with me. But when he went down into one, it just went deeper and deeper and deeper. And he said that, you know, when he got down to a certain point, he says the water started getting very murky.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't trust it, so he came back up again and, you know, and marked the spot. And since then, he's taken me several different times to this one particular area with these wells. The Indians called them, but
and for our listening audience, I am going to post some photographs of these stone circles. They're huge, they're very well organized, and it took some effort to move them. It's not something that one person can move. Each stone looks like it weighs a significant amount of weight. So,
well, I think that on one part of the lake, because it's a big size lake. And I think on one part of the lake, maybe people, you know, the natives lived. And then in the area where you find the pyramids and these structures, this is more sacred ceremonial ground and burial grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when these people were forced to, now this was like, if the listener looked at this, you know, by an aerial shot, you could see that there was a large creek, a stream that dumped into like a bowl,
mm-hmm.
which was so. And so anyhow, the ancient people had this dammed up. And they use this bowl, you know, a land bowl, mm-hmm. to build things in, you know, build their homes and, you know, and the sacred site, you know, the temples and the pyramids and all that. And they lived there for a long time. But then something happened. There for years, the only thing I could find was they called them the beast. And they said that the beast had arrived on the eastern shores, you know, of, you know, the coastal area of eastern United States. And whoever these people were, they called the beast, caused these ancient ones of Rock Lake to pack up everything that they had and to move to Mexico and down into the Yucatan area. But before they left, they broke that dam. And the waters rushed in and filled up that bowl, leaving this lake. And the reason for this was to protect their dead and, their treasures that they couldn't take with them.
Now, is there evidence of this wall dam that was left to us to observe? Or is this just like a story that the natives tell?
Well, you can actually find, I think I have pictures. I think it's burlingtonnews.net/rocklake.
Okay.
I think that's the address. But you can actually find old maps I have, aerial shots.
This is on your website, right?
Yeah, showing
okay.
the lands between Absalon, you know, which is an ancient ruin, and Rock Lake.
Wow.
And so I pretty much have it there that you can actually look at, and then I got aerial shots of it as well. So you can, just based on what I put up on my site, you can pretty much see how, you know, see the legend develop in front of your eyes, you know, as the truth.
That's really intriguing.
These actually predate the Egyptian pyramids.
Wow. And it's been carbon dated, huh? Is that why they can say that?
Well, you can't really carbon date. I don't know how they dated them, but it'd be very difficult to carbon date stone.
No, not stone. I mean, maybe they have artifacts that are around the base, or they found some organic matter within, a crypt or something within the pyramid or something. You know what I mean? It's
yeah. But Frank and I and the team we were with found something much more phenomenal than anything that is out there. And it is a pyramid. Now, this pyramid that we found, it's where the old creek or the old stream dumped into the lake. You know, that one that I talked about that had been dammed up.
Mm-hmm.
And about 120 yards in offshore into the lake, and about 19 feet down, we found the top of a pyramid.
Top of
a pyramid. This pyramid was different than anything that anyone has ever seen before, because this pyramid was like glass. But it was actually, I believe, obsidian. But it was so smooth, like the texture of glass, that algae didn't even grow on it. And it was, it was a black pyramid.
Oh, stop for a minute. So is this in the water or on the land?
Yeah. We found it 16 foot or 19 foot under the surface of the water.
So this is another pyramid. This is not the same one that they...
This is one that Frank and I found.
This is the second pyramid. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, and it's like 120 yards out from the shoreline in underneath the water there.
Okay.
And it had golden hieroglyphs written on the capstone.
Well, Mary, I hope we have photos of this. Photos, Mary.
No, we don't. And if you Frank and me have been kicking ourselves ever since, because we had a pontoon boat out there, and I think there was probably, I don't know, 9, maybe 10 of us that was on the pontoon. We had taken the day and we were out there looking for undiscovered structures, and they had been diving quite a lot that day. And what had happened was a person working for the DNR, Department of Natural Resources, had come out on a jet ski, mm-hmm. you know, to find out what we were up to, and And Frank had introduced himself to the ranger, and the ranger, realizing who Frank was, you know, kind of opened up a little bit to us and had told us. Now, if you go and you talk to the rangers, you know, the DNR or any of those guys around there, and ask about underwater pyramids of Rock Lake, they'll say, oh, we don't have any. That's just a myth. But he told us, now he was working that day, and like I said, he was working for the DNR, and he told Frank and myself and the people that was listening on the pontoon that DNR had a map of over 1,800 structures that they had mapped sitting on the bottom of Rock Lake.
So it's a significant location.
It's not just one pyramid. And anyhow, we tried talking him into. Well, he actually went back up on his the ski thing, whatever it is.
Jet ski, yeah.
What is jet ski? Yeah, he actually took off, went back to his car, and brought us the map. Got it out of his glove compartment, jumped back on his jet ski, brought it back out to the pontoon that we were on, and showed us the map of all the markings of all these structures that the DNR had.
Okay.
So he had suggested to us, well, if you're looking for any, you should go over to this one location. And we said, yeah, okay, thank you. And then we tried getting him to give us a copy of that map, and he just laughed. He says, the public will never see this map, right?
God.
So it was fine. So anyhow, he left, and Frank looked at me, and he says, we're going a different direction than what he pointed out.
Wow. Yeah.
And so I says, probably a good idea. So we went over to this other place that most of the researchers had never even went over and looked at. And we ended up over there, but it was at the end of the day. The oxygen tanks were just about empty, and we were just pretty much done for the day. And we were just kind of going, we went over there, and we had the underwater camera, you know, under the water, and we were just kind of sitting back and watching that to see what we could see. And the camera bounced off against this pyramid, and it circled around and bounced off again. And Frank and I are looking at it and say, wow, are you seeing what I'm seeing? I said, yeah, I'm seeing it. And everybody else comes running, and we're all looking at it.
Is this the side sonar scanner?
This was an underwater camera.
Okay. And so you were up on your boat, and this camera was underwater.
Yeah, it's kind of like a fish finder.
Right.
Okay. Something similar to, anyhow.
Okay.
So anyhow, so we're all looking at it, and Frank and those guys are getting their diving equipment on, and I'm telling them that we're drifting. And they wouldn't listen to me. And I kept telling them, I said, you're drifting. And anyhow, the boat drifted. And those guys couldn't find it down there again. And so anyhow, we marked the spot, and we were going to come back the next day. And anyhow, we never got back around to finding it the next day, but that was okay because, you know, we had marked the spot. I'd actually taken pictures, you know, pictures to the south, the north, the east, the west, you know, so that I could look at those pictures and know exactly where we were, because we didn't have a GPS on us. So anyhow, but as time went by, we just never got back around there because, you know, Frank lives way up in northern Wisconsin, and so it takes a little effort on his part to get down here. But the next time he came down, we went out with another bunch of people, and for 6 years, we knew exactly where it was.
Yeah.
But disappeared.
Well, let me ask you this, because we have to move on to the giants. And I want to ask you, you mentioned hieroglyphs on this survey. Now, who saw the hieroglyphs, you or Frank?
I also saw hieroglyphs.
Pardon me?
We all saw them. There was, like I said, 9 or 10 of us looking at it.
And when you say hieroglyphs, are you saying, are they distinctive Egyptian? Are they unique to?
They looked Egyptian.
They looked Egyptian. Okay. Wow. That's pretty astounding.
Yeah, and it was in the. But what was remarkable about the pyramid is, like I said, it looked like it was made out of black obsidian.
Wow.
Not regular river rock.
Okay.
And so anyhow, I think, you know, that what happened, as I found out, that with Rock Lake, the bottom shifts. You know, because of currents, and the bottom will shift like 3 times within a year, which we didn't know about. And I think what happened is we just got lucky. And as the currents were going through, it shifted all that sand off off that pyramid.
Okay.
And we were able to see, you know, like part of the capstone and then part of what was underneath the capstone. We didn't see the full thing because it was huge, you know, and you know, through the years the sand, you know, had, you know, filled it in. And I think that's what had happened, is it had always filled it in, but that particular day the bottom had shifted through the currents and it pushed all that sand off.
Yeah.
And we just got lucky and saw it. But the next time we went back, the bottom had shifted again and covered it up.
You need to get some kind of heavy-duty equipment to scan the surface, or drones or something to dig into that.
Oh, we have now. I mean, that was our first time out, you know.
Yeah.
And since then, we've gotten some remarkable equipment, you know.
Well, we'll wait for you to come back with us on the story of the century. Mary, if you
can actually find that story to the readers, because Frank was kind of, he didn't quite know if he wanted to even share that story.
I can see why. Yeah.
The fact of the embarrassment that we didn't get the pictures, I think.
Yeah.
But he actually, finally he called me up and he says, should we just run the story? And I says, yeah, we should. Right. Either people are going to believe us or they're not, you know. But I says the story should be shared.
Yeah,
and
well,
so I wrote the article, and it's in Atlantis Rising if anybody wants to follow up on it.
Right, Atlantis Rising. But for those of you listening, I have these rock circles to see on the Facebook page. Mary has been nice enough to send them to me. We also have other rock formations, and this is really spectacular. I have a video taken by a special drone that flew over Rock Lake, Wisconsin, and that actually you can see the pyramid. And it's a real sight to see because it's like, what the hell is that doing there?
But let the listeners know that it's not the Black Pyramid that Frank and I found.
It's not the one that they found. Well, you'll read about it, because the explanation and the rock formations and how it was made is all explained by the author, the videographer. So, Mary, amazing. I want to hear more about that as soon as you can dig up some more evidence for it. Sounds fascinating. Okay, we're on to the red-haired giants, Atlantis in North America. Now, we didn't drill down enough when you were with us last time about these physical giants. Let's start off by talking a little bit about the history of them. When you say giant, what are we talking about in terms of scale? Are we talking 8 footers, 7.5 feet, or are we getting up beyond the teens when we talk about their sheer size?
So to answer your question, the Sauk Indians, when they were in the Burlington area. Now, for the people, Burlington would be, Burlington would be north of Chicago.
Okay.
And in between Rock Lake and Chicago. So it's not that much of a difference in area. The people of Burlington basically are the same people as the people of Rock Lake, all right? And so Losing my train of thought here. Oh, so anyhow, the sock, which now, as of in my new book coming out, Red-Haired Giants Revisited, I will show that these Sauk Indians actually were written about in the ancient Vedic texts, and that, and they showed that Krishna and Vishnu, all those guys, had actually visited North America when it was called Atlan. And notice Atlan in the remember over by Rock Lake, they have a city, okay. An ancient city by the name of Atlan. So basically Atlan, Atlan, Atlantis, all kind of the same. But anyhow, the Sauk, you'll be able to read about how they, their influence, you know, on North America, you know, and the everything actually goes back to Brahmin history.
Brahmin, like in India, Brahmin?
Yeah.
Okay.
Everything.
India. Okay.
Yeah, and I came across that in Burlington, because in Burlington we have the river that went through there, and it was called Pishtaka. And myself, along with everybody else, always thought that it was just an Indian name for the Fox River. And as I was doing some research, I came across something about Pishtaka and found out it was a Brahmin term. It wasn't Indian, it was Brahmin. And I was like, well, how the heck would our Indians, the Sauk Indians, know names of Brahma? You know? But Brahma, or Pishtaka, means rice. And the Pishtaka River, the Fox River, Lewis and Clark said was like a river of rice.
Okay.
Described it.
Let's
so
go back to my first question, though, Mary. How big were these guys? Are they?
Well, that's what I'm getting to.
Okay.
So anyhow, so I started looking around, searching, in the area, and came across some Indian legends of the Sauk and the Fox, where they described people living there before they had arrived in that area. And they were called the Hukadesh, Hukadesh, Kadesh, very, very, very important word. And so anyhow, and they described them as being known as the Hukadesh. They were a red-haired white, or their skin tone was white. They had red hair and were giants. Measuring from, you know, the average was probably 8 to 10 foot tall.
8 to 10 foot. Okay. Well, that's pretty good size.
And they were proportioned according to their height. And they said that the population of these people, which they called the stone builders, was as thick as the leaves on the trees.
Okay.
And so at that point in time, that's where my life, as everybody used to know it, ended. And I have dedicated my entire life since then to tracing down this race of red-haired giants.
Okay.
And their traditions, were they here prior to? How did they arrive? You know, wars they had been into, their religious beliefs, everything you can think of. And like I said, with the information that I have on them, with the references, I have built a case where I feel I could go to court and actually win my case.
Now, I will say this, though. You have a number of excellent photographs. You have a private collector who collected over 9,000 artifacts, and I saw some of your photographs. Some of the arrowheads are huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I mean, they're bigger than your hand, and some of the axe heads and things. So you have substantiated evidence there, but the smoking gun, and this is the smoking gun that I ask each of these researchers like yourself who are looking into the giant question, where are the physical remains? And
well, I have physical remains.
Okay, I want to hear about that. That's huge.
You probably, Frank, he hates it when I start showing my remains because they're pretty much petrified.
Hey, I'll take anything I can get. If you got some new photos, Mary, if you got new photos, I'll put it up for the world to see. But I mean, that's the big key. You know, I mean, your book, and I'm just going to say this flat out, every single giant book spends a third or more of the book slapping the Smithsonian Institute around, hiding the bones, burning the bones, dissolving the bones. I mean, okay, we're tired of that. It's been a long time now. It's been since the 1800s. Let's have a come to Jesus moment and find us some bones. So, Mary, what do you got?
I don't know if I should. I don't.
Mary, well, this is okay, exclusive. We want an exclusive, Mary. Give us the bones.
Oh my God! If I told you some of the things I had, I think Frank would blow his top of his head off. I have, I've got like petrified fingers. Okay. I hate to even say this, and the people are going to listen and they're going to be screaming at me.
We need a femur or a forearm or a rib cage or you know
what? Would a penis do?
Oh my God.
A petrified penis?
I think that pushes
this is
it, but
what I'm saying.
At this
if Frank knew that I was talking about this, he'd be blowing off top of his head off.
Well, I mean, do you have any like footprints or legs or bones?
I have skull.
You have a skull?
Uh-huh. And I have, let's see, what else do I got?
Okay, well, if you have a skull, you're crossing into the...
Part of a femur. And let's see.
Let me just stop you for a minute, Mary. So tell me about the skull. Is it Homo sapien? Is it a giant with double rows of teeth like every other?
Well, now they have found elongated skulls here in Wisconsin.
I know.
And they had been at one time put on display in the museum, but I don't know where they're at anymore. So I do know that we've had elongated skulls. But the skull that I have is it's not elongated, and it doesn't really – I think that this is from what I can tell, you know, based on other people, you know, different people that have looked at it's probably over a million years old. So that would kind of be pre-redheaded giants that I'm working on now. I found that in the state of Kentucky.
Now, yeah, I want to talk about Kentucky in a minute. One of the things that you report about, and a number of our other authors have talked about it, is that 10,000 or 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, there were copper mines up and down the Wisconsin area.
Right.
And strangely enough, this friend of yours, this private collector that had these 9,000 artifacts, 142 of them were copper artifacts. Can you talk a little bit about those?
We've actually found in Burlington casted copper artifacts. You know, like how you make cast in a foundry.
Yeah. Wow, really?
So they were actually casting way back then.
What were they casting? What did you find? What kind of a mold was it?
Let's see. I think that Well, I have it in my book, The Red-Haired Giants. A guy by the, you know, believe it, well, this is another thing that most people don't realize this, but there was a man in Burlington, Wisconsin. His name was F.S. Perkins.
Right.
And this goes back in the days of the horse and wagons.
Yeah,
right?
I was going to talk to you about him. 1836 is when he made some discoveries. But go ahead. You tell the story.
Yeah, and if it hadn't been for that one man, we would have never known about these ancient copper miners. Because before he died, he had thousands upon thousands of copper artifacts. But prior to him giving these to the museums, including the Smithsonian, it's like these what they call upalas. They're kind of out of place artifacts. Yeah, so I mean, the Smithsonian had a couple, maybe Milwaukee had one, or you know, but they were just like one or two little pieces where they couldn't make any rhyme or reason as to what they were, where they came from, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the diligence of F.S. Perkins, he would go around once a week, twice a week, something like that, with his horse and wagon, go to all these farmers and pay them, you know, a penny or whatever, for each piece of copper artifacts that they had uncovered in their fields as they were plowing.
Hmm.
And he was getting axes, he was getting vases, bones.
Well, let me just stop you right there, Mary. Can you tell me what you saw of copper artifacts from that private collection? Because you actually used the term number 142 artifacts that were copper. So I'm assuming this private collector said, hey, I got a lot. And by the way, I have 142 copper artifacts. What kind of artifacts were they?
Well, that basically would have been, axe heads.
Axe heads. Okay.
Wow. Uh-huh. Arrowheads.
Okay.
Things like that, smaller wow. pieces.
That's amazing. That's great. I love yeah. it.
Well, now, I have this one, you know, but of course, well, you know, this is, and Cliff, you know this yourself, and it really makes it hard on us researchers that are trying to get the truth out to the people. But sometimes we have to abide by these certain people's, you know, requests.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, that. In order to even see or photograph, mm-hmm. you know, some of these pieces. I had this one gentleman that he had uncovered a giant burial site. And he sent me the pictures. He documented the whole thing through taking pictures. And when he got the thing uncovered, there laid the skeletal remains of a full grown adult giant. But of course, and you know this yourself, and I know the listeners hate this from all of us, but sometimes we just have to do what we got to do in order to get any information. I do have the pictures of the giant that he uncovered.
Hello, Mary, Mary, stop. I need those. I need those. Mary, we got to see pictures because.
Well, I've got the pictures, but okay. I can't give out location and I can't give out his name.
No.
Right?
Send me the pictures, Mary. Mary, send me the pictures because if you have pictures of a slain giant, and what's the estimated height? 8-10 feet? How tall is it?
I would think it's probably about 10 or 8 foot.
Okay, are these clear, good shots of the remains?
Well, it is what it is, you know, because you know he was buried for a long time, so you know he's dirty and
okay.
stuff.
Okay, so
like
you heard it
you know,
here.
You got the bones, or anything?
You guys that are listening, Mary's going to send me a photograph and we're going to post it. And that's going to be, Mary's going to be queen for the week or month or year for disseminating this information, because the biggest issue is that I've had in all the years I've interviewed authors who talk about giants is there's no evidence of these bones. So there's lots of good reference material, but there's no evidence. There's no photo. So if you
but
could,
but there's two things that I always go by with this, Cliff.
What
is one? When you take it back to the days of the dinosaur, everything was gigantic in proportion. Everything was the plants, the insects, the dinosaur. So everything was gigantic.
So the environment was just different.
Yeah, it wouldn't even made any sense that the humans at that time would have been 5'4". Second, with my argument I use is the recessive gene. Mm-hmm. Because people say, well, there can't be, giants. Okay. Well, we still, through recessive genes, are still bearing out giants.
Okay.
I mean, we have pictures of modern day giants that are 8 foot.
But those guys have genetic issues and they're just moving. They're miserable.
That's what they say. But it could also be a recessive gene.
Okay. All right, Mary, we're getting down to it. I have a few more questions, but I'm telling the audience that this photograph of a unearthed giant will be posted on the Earth Ancients Facebook and website. Is that something that you're agreeing to do?
Yeah.
Okay. You heard it here, everybody.
Oh, no, I don't have no problems, but, of course, you have to protect your source because for one thing, it's illegal to dig in, dig up something like this and not report it.
Well, unless it's on the guy's property, if it's on your own property.
Even if it's on your own property.
Oh, really? This is news to me. So
if
you have property and you have a mound on your property and you dig into it, it has to be reported, huh?
You cannot dig into it until you get an archaeologist there.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, that's...
And if it's of any of great importance, you have to have an archaeologist that is above the other archaeologist to come in.
So he can hide it and send it to the Smithsonian. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, hey, Mary, here's a few more. We're coming to the end of our time. Here is something I want to ask you. Number one, You kind of explain it. The environment changed, so these huge human beings couldn't exist anymore. You said it yourself that your belief is that everything was big. There were bigger plants. They were maybe the last vestiges of dinosaurs or huge animals, and they're just everything was bigger. Which, to my mind, would make me think that the gravitation was different on the Earth. Allowing people to get bigger. And so that's a very interesting point. But how, to me it's obvious, but how do you think these giants died out? Was it just environmental causes or were they slow?
Well, I know that if you go back biblically to the days of Joshua, I think it's in Deuteronomy, there was instructions to Joshua and his people to wipe out every one of these people off the face of the earth.
All the giants, huh? Okay.
Yeah. And so that had, so Joshua went from the Middle East down into Africa, up into Europe, following, these various tribes of giants to exterminate them. And the last battle was in New York, called the Battle of Kadesh. There again,
New York. So what's the estimated time?
It was a Battle of Kadesh. It was can't even think of it. But it was in New York.
Okay.
But anyhow, that's what started the Mormon religion, and a new science called archaeology.
What's the time frame? What's
the battlefield? They found these bones of giants and various artifacts.
Mary,
you know?
What's the time period for this period in New York? Well, how long ago?
Jeez. Well, you go back to when did Joseph Smith start up the Mormon religion? Because once Joseph Smith found these giants and these what they call burial plates. The race was on. He started up the Mormon religion, and a bunch of those guys, that was their jobs, was to go and dig up as many mounds as they could find and look for artifacts to tell about who these people were, what their traditions were, et cetera, et cetera. And usually the priest king he would carry, upon death being buried, he would have these, what they call burial plates, that it was kind of like on a chain or something like that around his neck. Mm-hmm. I suppose they figured once they die, they might lose memory. So they would keep all the pertinent information inscribed on these burial plates. So the Mormons were looking for these burial plates and various artifacts. And that new department of archaeology, they were doing the same thing. So it was like a race between the Mormons and archaeologists to get dig up as many of these mounds as possible and get as much information on them.
Okay. Wow. Okay, Mary. This has been fascinating. You have actually elevated the entire research community by advancing a photograph to us that we will post of a buried, I think you said, 8-foot giant.
Yeah, I think that's about the size of it.
Okay. Now, my last question to you is, what is the most important takeaway that you want people to have regarding this Wisconsin, the book, Red Hair Giants? And this, I'm going to say Wisconsin because that's kind of your focus, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm all into self-empowerment. Mm-hmm. And in order for us to make the correct decisions on anything, we need the total truth, but we need to know both sides of the coin. And so basically, I just go out there and I write about it like I did the red-haired giants. I try to tell people the truth on misplaced or forgotten segments of history so that, we learn from our past mistakes. And we cannot learn from past mistakes if we don't realize that we had a past with these red-haired giants.
Fantastic. Mary, the book is The Red-Haired Giants. You can read more about all of these. Mary, what's your website so people can go to your website?
For my books, they can go to burlingtonnews.net.
BurlingtonNews.net. Okay,
that's all one word. So BurlingtonNews.net/books, BOOKS.
Okay.
And I do a regular study group where I post, I'm constantly posting on Facebook.com/groups/Mary Sutherland.
Right.
And okay. So people can go in there. They can look at my pictures, which I'm sure I've got pictures of a lot of these artifacts, with the exception of, that one. And and then it's like Frank says, "Oh, no, you're not bringing that thing again, are you?" But hey, an artifact's an artifact to me.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyhow, they can the things that we discuss, they can find on Facebook. Or what's really nice is what I have at my BurlingtonNews.net site. That's my homepage, BurlingtonNews.net. I have my own search engine. And so any topic that a person is interested in, anything, if I've written about it, it's going to show up in that search engine. So let's say you're interested in giants. So you just find that search engine in their little box and you type in giants and click, search. And every website that I have written on giants will pop up.
Okay, good. That's good to know.
Yeah, and I've got my website's probably like New York City, a map of New York City.
Yeah, it's quite large. Listen, this is perfect, and I will post these the links to the website on the Facebook page, of course, with this pristine photograph, which
it's not pristine, but it is what it is, you know.
Okay, but is it a full body shot or just the head or what? Full body?
Yeah. Okay. No, it's the grave itself and the digging and.
What would you say? What was the year? What year was it taken? The photograph.
Gosh, within the last. Within the last 6 years, maybe.
Okay, that's fairly recent. That's good, Mary. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Fantastic. I'm looking forward to hearing more good things from you, and let's have you back. Okay.
And I appreciate, Cliff, you having me. And thank you all, listeners, for spending your time with us.
So I have the complete gallery of this dig, this burial. The photographs aren't great, but it's pretty significant. It's serious news in my book. And you can see the entire gallery if you become a subscriber of Earth Ancients. And for as little as $5 a month, you can see galleries, you can hear unpublished interviews, my notes, my articles, as well as a number of videos that I do not post. These are just for Patreon subscribers. To subscribe, go to patreon.com/earthancients. Patreon is becoming a significant support system, and when you support Earth Ancients, you allow me to grow the show. So, you know, think about it. $5 a month for top-notch material. I really appreciate it. That's it for today's show. I want to thank Curtis Hartog, Mark Foster, LeGrand Green, and everyone else that helped make the show happen. As always, be well, and we will see you next time.